You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of a collection of lectures, possibly a cycle, entitled Secret Brotherhoods and the Mystery of the Human Double by Rudolf Steiner. It is Collected Works, Volume 178, and it is translated by Joanna Collis. This is a public lecture given in St. Gallen on the 15th of November, 1917, and it is entitled Knowledge of the Supersensible and Riddles of the Human Soul. Tracing how the human spirit evolves across the centuries and millennia leads to a sense of how it progresses step by step, ever and again, to new and yet more new achievements in the field of knowledge as well as in the field of action. Perhaps one should not place too much emphasis on the word progress as such, since this might raise serious doubts in certain connections, in view of the tragic times that have befallen humanity just now. But apart from this, it must surely be obvious to all those who are interested in the evolution of the human spirit that the forms in which this spirit casts its efforts undergo radical changes over the course of centuries. In what I want to put before you today, we shall strive to understand something new that wants to enter into human evolution. So we shall be helped by comparing this with other situations in which similarly new elements came into conflict with older views and had difficulty in taking hold as humanity evolved. How difficult it was, for example, to establish the validity of the Copernican view of the world in the face of people's habits of thought and feeling. In the case of certain aspects, it took centuries to establish this view, which broke with what people had, for ages, considered to be the truth about the structure of their universe based on what they could see with their own eyes. A time had come when they could no longer rely on what their eyes told them about how the sun moved, rising and then setting again. In opposition to what they saw, they had to concede that the sun stood still, at least in its relation to the earth. People's established habits of thinking and feeling do not fit in easily with such revolutions in knowledge. In the case of the spiritual science of anthroposophy, which is to be the subject of this evening's talk, we are dealing with an even greater turnaround. There are good and firm scientific grounds for being convinced that the content of this spiritual science, too, must now take its place in the further evolution of human thinking and feeling. In the hope that you will not be offended, I would like to begin by introducing this subject as follows. The Copernican worldview, like many other things, was opposed by countless prejudices and traditional opinions, because people believed that if they were to replace them by something else, this would spell the end of all kinds of religious ideas, and so on. But in the case of what I shall be speaking about this evening, a great deal more is rising up as well. It is here not only a matter of the kind of prejudices that stood against the Copernican worldview. The problem here is that very many people in our time, the majority, in fact, people who consider themselves to be enlightened and well-educated, are raising up more than their prejudices and assumptions in opposition. For these enlightened and well-educated individuals quite simply feel embarrassed to enter, in all seriousness, into the realms of which anthroposophy has to speak. They feel they are letting themselves down, not only in front of those around them, but in front of themselves, if they admit that it is possible to gain knowledge regarding the subject we shall be discussing today that is just as scientific as knowledge regarding external nature and its structures. They feel they are making fools of themselves or behaving childishly in their own eyes. These are the factors that have to be taken into account when speaking today about the spiritual science of anthroposophy. Someone speaking about this science on the basis of real knowledge about it is only too familiar with the hundredfold, even thousandfold, objections that are raised. Such a person is familiar with the objections simply because it is not only the separate truths and results of this spiritual science which are doubted, but the very fact that there can be any true knowledge about the realm with which the spiritual science of anthroposophy is concerned. Very many people still regard it as entirely justifiable to develop beliefs, general beliefs about the realm of the eternal in the human soul. But when it comes to facts not understood in the world of the senses, facts pertaining to what is immortal and eternal in human nature, then those who form their judgments on the basis of our perfectly valid present-day scientific thinking regard as mainly fantasy and visionary nonsense the statement that actual factual knowledge can be gained about such things. Well, this evening we shall not be dealing with any fantasy or visionary nonsense, but with a realm that may well put off many, especially those who consider themselves to be scientific in their thinking. But first, let me also briefly mention that the spiritual science of anthroposophy has no intention of being in any way sectarian. Anyone assuming that it is intended to be the foundation of some sort of new religious denomination is entirely mistaken as to its nature. As it is today, anthroposophy is a necessary consequence of what scientific progress has produced by way of a worldview, a general, even popular worldview held by the widest circles of humanity. This scientific progress that has yielded so many concepts on which the worldview of the widest circles is based, concepts which are in turn the source of feelings and sentiments, this scientific way of looking at the world has assumed the task of exploring and explaining whatever can be detected by our external senses, whatever natural laws about facts observable by the outer senses can be comprehended by the human mind. Even if we pay attention only to the realm of life, things are more obscure in other realms, but the realm of life shows up the matter very clearly, then we can see how, in every case, science must endeavor to work its way back to the origins, to whatever is the original seed for what grows and comes into being, for whatever flourishes. When scientists want to give their own explanation of animal or human life, they look back to birth. They study embryology. They study whatever it is out of which something that is growing emerges. Science goes right back to the beginning of what can be perceived by the senses, namely birth. Or, if it wants to explain the world as a whole, then it goes back via various hypotheses based on geology, paleontology, or whatever the various branches of science have to offer, to what can be imagined as regards the birth of the world's whole structure. Although one individual or another may have expressed doubts as to the justification for such a way of thinking, nevertheless, it is this thinking that has always been applied. We know what ideas have been put forward in the attempt to penetrate, if not to the very beginning of Earth's existence, then at least to far distant periods of evolution, for example, those when man did not yet exist on the Earth. We know what has been put forward, to explain in some measure how what came afterward as the perceptible world human beings have around them emerged from what was there before in seed form. Darwin's theory, or if you want to leave that out of account, the theory of evolution as such, all such theories stand on discovering how something that comes into being arises out of something that was there before. Wherever you look, the effort is made to go back to younger times and birth. The spiritual science of anthroposophy occupies a different position. Its point of departure is the very thing that initially engenders objections without people realizing this fully. The objections are unclear. They should be termed subconscious or instinctive. And such objections are often far more effective than those which are clearly recognized and thought through. In order to reach clear ideas, not vague generalities about spiritual concepts, but actual spiritual facts, the spiritual science of anthroposophy has to make death its point of departure. From the start, it thus finds itself in fundamental opposition to the favored manner of proceeding today, when birth and youth, growth and forward steps in development are the point of departure. Death intervenes in life. Wherever you look in scientific literature today, you will find that conscientious researchers consider it impossible to see death as such as a scientific concept. Yet the scientist of the spirit has to regard death, that which comes to an end and is the opposite of birth, as his starting point. For him, the fundamental question to be asked is, how does death, and whatever is connected with it, intervene in life in the wider sense? Death brings to an end whatever the senses can perceive. Death dissolves what comes into being and what evolves in full view of the senses. Death intervenes, like something we imagine to be unconcerned with what is at work here in the sense-perceptible world, where everything flourishes, springs up, and lives. So the view arises, wrongly, but to some extent quite understandably, that we can know nothing about what death covers up and hides. This is the facet of human feeling which leads to all the counter-arguments that can of course be raised against the results of what is, after all, still a young science. It is indeed still a young science, and for the reasons just mentioned, the spiritual scientist, even when speaking about the discoveries of his science, finds himself in a situation quite different from that of the natural scientist. The spiritual scientist cannot proceed in the same way as the natural scientist, who states a fact and then proves it on the basis of the conviction that people can see it with their own eyes. The spiritual scientist speaks about things that cannot be perceived with the senses. Therefore, when speaking about the results of his research, he is always obliged to indicate how these results are achieved. There is now a rich vein of literature on the realm about which I shall be speaking to you this evening. Even though they thereby merely prove how inaccurately and superficially they read, critics who feel called upon to complain, for example, about what I have written, keep on maintaining that this scientist of the spirit makes statements which he does not prove. Well, dear members of the audience, he does bring proof, but he does so in a different way. He begins by describing how he has reached his conclusions, for he first has to show the path by which he has entered into the realm of these facts. This path, in itself, is often off-putting, because it is unfamiliar to present-day habits of thinking and feeling. Although the spiritual scientist does not reject the methods by which natural science reaches its brilliant results, but rather admires them greatly. The very nature of his research leads him to the inescapable conclusion that those methods cannot serve as a means by which to enter the supersensible realm. Indeed, the spiritual scientist finds his point of departure in the very experience of how limited the procedures of that scientific thinking are. When natural science reaches the final boundary of knowledge in a certain area, what so often happens nowadays is that people simply say, quote, "Here we have reached the limit of what human beings can know." Close quote. Spiritual science, however, endeavors to use this very limit to come to certain experiences which can only be attained at such boundaries. I have specifically discussed these boundaries of human knowing in my book titled Von Seelenrätseln, Riddles of the Soul, which is being published just now. Those who have not taken knowledge to be something that just happens to land on them from outside, but who have wrestled with knowledge and with truth, such people have always had certain experiences when coming up against their outer limits. But times are changing, and human evolution is going through transformations. Even quite recently, the most outstanding thinkers and wrestlers with knowledge fetched up at these outer limits with the attitude that they could go no further, that this was where they would have to come to a halt. Those of you who have heard me speak a few times will know that it is rarely my habit to touch on personal matters. But since personal experience is here bound up with what I am trying to put forward, I hope you will allow me to do so on this occasion. I have to say that what I want to explain about these experiences at the outer limits of knowledge is founded on more than 30 years of continuous spiritual research. It was over 30 years ago that these problems and tasks, these riddles that arise at the outer limits of knowledge, first made a strong impression on me. There are many examples I could quote regarding these boundaries, but let me mention one which was pointed out by a genuine wrestler with knowledge, Friedrich Theodor Fischer, the well-known aesthete, who was also a most important philosopher, although during his lifetime he was too little recognized and soon forgotten. Several decades ago, Fischer wrote a very interesting discourse on a very interesting book on imagination in dreams by Foulkelt. He mentioned a number of things which might not concern us here, which need not concern us here, but there is one sentence one might easily fail to notice, but which, on the other hand, could strike the soul like a bolt of lightning if that soul were filled with the desire for knowledge and were truly struggling inwardly for real knowledge. It is a sentence that occurred to Fischer as he pondered and wondered about the nature of the human soul. Thinking about what science had had to say about the human being in recent times, he deduced, "It is quite clear that this human soul cannot be solely within the body, but it is equally clear that it cannot be outside the body either." We are here confronted with a complete contradiction, one that cannot easily be solved. It is a contradiction that must of necessity present itself to someone who is seriously concerned with the struggle for knowledge. The time had not yet arrived when it would have been possible for Fischer to push on from that limit of ordinary knowledge to an inner experience of such a contradiction. Even today, from most of those seeking knowledge, we still hear what occurs to them when they come up against such a contradiction. And there are hundreds and hundreds of such contradictions, like the seven riddles of the universe mentioned by Dubois-Raymond, that witty physiologist. What those seeking knowledge today continue to say is, "This is as far as human knowledge can go. It cannot get beyond this point." This is said by these individuals because when they reach a limit of human knowledge, they cannot bring themselves to make the step from mere thinking, mere inner pictures, to actual experience. The place to begin is where such a contradiction brings us up short. Not one that we have cleverly thought out ourselves, but one that is revealed to us by the universal riddles. We must try to live continuously with that contradiction, wrestling with it time and again as we do with ordinary problems in life. Indeed, we must immerse ourselves in it with our whole soul. We have to muster the courage of thinking, and with this immerse ourselves in the contradiction without fearing that it might shatter the picture formations in our soul or that our soul might not be capable of taking the next step. In my book, Von Seelenrätseln, I have quite recently described in detail this wrestling that must take place at those outer limits of knowledge. We can make progress when we arrive at one of these boundaries with all the fullness of our soul, rather than merely with the ideas we manufacture or cleverly work out and fix for ourselves. Our progress is not merely a matter of logic, for it is on the path of living knowledge that we then proceed. I shall have to use a comparison to describe what we experience there, for the path of spiritual research is a genuine experience of knowledge, a fact of knowledge, and language does not yet have many expressions for such things, since our words only serve for external perceptions brought to us by our senses. So what we see quite clearly before our spiritual eyes can only be expressed by means of a comparison. When we enter in a living way into a contradiction of the kind we are speaking about, we feel as though we have reached a barrier at which the spiritual world, not found in the sense-perceptible world, is knocking as though from the outside. It does not matter if the picture I want to use is not entirely accurate scientifically, for it is sufficient for use as a means of comparison. It is as though a living creature of a primitive order, which has not yet evolved a sense of touch, were to experience inwardly through constant inward movements the barriers of the physical world and the surfaces of separate objects. A creature that has not yet evolved a sense of touch, but which experiences the surfaces of things in this way, is as yet still entirely enclosed within itself. It cannot as yet feel, by means of touch, what is outside it in the way of sense-perceptible impressions. This is how someone who wrestles with knowledge feels, entirely in the sphere of spirit and soul, and certainly not in any material way, when he arrives at a borderline place such as I have just described. When the organism of a primitive creature breaks through like this, it becomes differentiated out into an organ for the sense of touch, as the result of colliding with the sense-perceptible world outside it. It can then feel the surfaces and know whether they are rough or smooth, hot or cold. It opens up what is inside it to what is outside it. In a similar way, one who wrestles with knowledge can break through a boundary and acquire a spiritual organ of touch. Having wrestled, perhaps for many years, to break through into the spiritual world at a boundary of knowledge, we come to a point where we gain real spiritual organs. This is only a very elementary description of how such a sense of touch can develop. If I may use certain expressions by giving them a fuller meaning, out of our state of being, enclosed within ourselves, we can develop spiritual eyes and spiritual ears if we work and work at this ever and ever again. Many today still find it absurd to speak of the soul being initially as undifferentiated as the organism of a primitive creature, and of it being able to form its senses out of its own substance, so that out of that substance soul instruments, differentiated soul organs, can be formed for perceiving the spirit. Organs which then confront the soul with the spiritual world. That the time has now come when it can be said that spiritual science, presented scientifically with full justification, is entering in a new way into the progress of knowledge which human evolution is undergoing. This is not entirely new in all respects, for we can see how especially the most outstanding searchers for knowledge sought and strove to attain spiritual knowledge in past times. Just now I mentioned Friedrich Theodor Fischer. Let us hear him describe in his own words how he came to stand before one of those outer limits of knowledge, how he stopped there without crossing it, how he did not make the transition from that inner stirring to the breakthrough which would have given him a spiritual sense of touch. I shall read you the passage where he describes how, in wrestling with the riddles of science, he reached one of those places where the spiritual world hammers at the door of the human soul. This happened at a time when materialistic science was presenting serious seekers for knowledge with numerous riddles, which led many to say that the only way to view the soul was to see it as nothing but a product of physical effects. Here are his words, quote, "No spirit where there is no nerve center, where there is no brain," say the opponents. "No nerve center, no brain," say we, if countless stages have not prepared it from below. It is easy to jest about a rumbling of spirit in granite or limestone, no harder than it would be for us to ask mockingly how it is possible for the protein in the brain to rise up and produce ideas. Yet how those stages might be measured escapes human understanding. We cannot fathom how spirit can produce nature as a counterstroke so perfect that to knock against it gives us bruises. Close quote. Note, please, how this man, who is wrestling for knowledge, describes us as being bruised in the process. Here you have the inner experience of one who, in wrestling for knowledge, is having to hammer away at it. Fischer continues, quote, "And here we come to a fundamental parting of the ways from any such apparent metaphysical absolute, since the Hegelian formulations, being other than itself and being outside itself, witty, perhaps, but with little meaning, merely disguise the radical nature of the dividing wall which we seem to have come up against. In Fichte, due recognition is given to the cut and thrust implicit in this counter-stroke that stands over against the spirit, but it is not really explained." Close quote. Here we have a description of someone who is wrestling for knowledge at a time when it was not yet possible for the decision of spiritual science, to be taken to go beyond the stroke and counterstroke and break right through the dividing wall that separates us from the spiritual world. I can only speak about these things in general here, but you can find detailed descriptions in my books, specifically entitled How to Know Higher Worlds, and the second part of title An Outline of Esoteric Science. You will find detailed descriptions of the inner agility and exercises the soul will have to practice, if I may be allowed this expression, in order to transform its undifferentiated state into spiritual organs, which can then perceive the spiritual world. Much has to be done if one wants to follow this path of genuine research. Much has to be done, because in our time habits of thought have evolved in the field of scientific study, which, while being fully appropriate for this field, amount to a specific way of thinking that is the opposite of the ways of thinking that lead into the spiritual world. It is therefore perfectly understandable that the pronouncements which come from the scientific angle show no wish to understand the spiritual world as it really is, with all its facts. The one thing I want to say here, for as I have said, you will find detailed descriptions in the books just mentioned, is that people will have to strive for quite a different way of forming inner concepts. In ordinary life, we are satisfied with concepts and inner pictures so long as they provide an image of some external fact or thing. But for spiritual research, this is unsatisfactory. For the soul of the spiritual researcher, inner pictures and concepts become something quite unlike those of today's ordinary habits of thought. Let me once again use a comparison to show how a spiritual researcher confronts the world today. Materialists, spiritualists, pantheists, monadists, all such people believe they can penetrate the riddles of the universe. By applying certain inner pictures or concepts, they attempt to gain an idea of universal processes. This is not at all the way in which spiritual researchers regard concepts. For them, these have to be approached in the clear knowledge that in the external sense-perceptible world, concepts or inner pictures are no different from, say, a photograph taken of a tree or other object from one specific angle. A photograph taken from one angle gives you a picture from that angle, while another taken from a different angle results in a different picture. From a third and fourth angle, you get two further pictures. The pictures are all different, but together, when you combine them in your mind's eye, they give you an inner image of the complete tree. Yet it is easy to say that one picture contradicts the other, for things look very different depending on the angle from which the photographs are taken. So, for a spiritual researcher, all those ideas put forward by pantheists, monadists, and so on are nothing more than different photographs of reality. Spiritual reality does not open itself to our life of ideas and concepts if we maintain that a concept is a true image. For we must go all round something and form many, many concepts about it from all angles. This enables us to develop a much more extensive and agile inner life of soul than we are used to having in the external world of the senses. It also means that we have to make concepts much more alive. They are then no longer mere copies, for by experiencing them, we make them into something much more alive than ordinary life and the things put in it. Let me put this in another way. Think of a rose that has been cut from a rose bush. Imagine it to yourself. When you make an inner picture of it, you may often feel it to be something real, as if the rose were something real. A spiritual researcher, on the other hand, will never make progress by being satisfied that the rose is something real. A rose imagined all by itself with a short stalk is nothing real, for it can only exist if it is part of the rose bush. It is the rose bush that is real. So for all the separate items of which people make inner pictures for themselves, believing these to be something real, the spiritual researcher must be constantly aware of the limited degree to which such a thing is actually a reality. When imagining a rose with a stalk, he must feel that it is not something real. He must sense and feel and experience the degree of unreality that is contained in this rose that is merely a single bloom. By extending this to cover our whole way of viewing the world, we cause our world of inner pictures to come alive. Instead of the paralyzed, dead inner pictures with which science is satisfied today, we gain inner pictures that are as alive as the things imagined. However, if we take today's habits of thought as our point of departure, we shall at first be disappointed. There will be disappointments for us, because what we experience will be so very different from the thought habits of today. It is unavoidable that what one says on the basis of knowledge of the spiritual world must sometimes sound rather paradoxical with regard to what is generally said and believed nowadays. It is possible to be tremendously scholarly, let's say in physics. One can be immensely scholarly and much admired on account of one's scholarship while working with all kinds of concepts that have not been reached or worked on in the manner I have described, which brings one's world of inner pictures to life. What I said was very elementary, but in a spiritual researcher, this elementary work must encompass one's whole way of viewing the world. Let me give an example. Earlier in this century, Professor Dewar made a very important lecture in London. Every sentence of that lecture revealed a great scholar of the present time, one who is as thoroughly versed in the ideas of physics as anyone can possibly be. Based on the ideas of physics as they are at present, this professor endeavors to speak about the final condition of the earth, or rather about some future condition, in which much of what is still here now will have died away. His descriptions are very accurate, for they are based on well-founded assumptions. He describes a condition of the earth several millions of years in the future, when the temperature will have sunk by so and so many hundred degrees, so that certain substances, this is quite easy to calculate, will have changed. This can be calculated, and he describes how milk, for example, will not be liquid, as it is today, but solid, or how the albumin in eggs painted onto walls will give off so much light that one will be able to read the newspaper without the need for any other light source. He gives many other such examples. Objects which cannot withstand even a few grams of pressure will have such a strong consistency that it will be possible to suspend hundreds of kilograms from them. In short, Professor Dewar gives a marvelous account of a future state of the earth. From the point of view of physics, one cannot raise the slightest objection. But these things look entirely different to someone whose soul is filled with living thinking. If someone who has taken living thinking into his soul were to ponder the ideas put forward in the way this professor has done, he would immediately find himself confronted with something that would make him draw conclusions by a method and from a viewpoint which very much resembled the deductions and thought processes of the professor. Let us assume that a 25-year-old human being were to be minutely observed, as can be done nowadays with the help of radiology. Certain organs, let us say the stomach, are observed, and the changes that take place year by year are noted. The changes in configuration are noted. This can be done in the same way as the physicist compares the sequence of changes in the Earth's condition and then works out what the Earth must look like after several million years. In the case of the human being, you observe how, let us say, the stomach or the heart changes year by year. Then, in accordance with these changes, you calculate what the human being must look like after, say, 200 years. If you do your calculations correctly, the conclusions you reach will be just as well-founded. Only the person would have died long ago. He would no longer exist. You see what I mean? From our own experience, we know that in this case, all these calculations are totally unrealistic, since the human body, with all those changes, would no longer exist. Yet in the case of the Earth, such calculations are made. One fails to take into account that after 2 million years, the Earth will also have passed away and no longer exist as a physical entity. So that all these scholarly calculations about its condition have no value in reality, since the reality they refer to will no longer exist. These things are far-reaching. In the case of a human being, you can equally well make the calculations backward, and on the basis of the changes that have occurred over 2 years, work out what he looked like 200 years ago, only he did not exist then. The Kant-Laplace theory has been worked out by the same method. This assumes that once upon a time there was a nebulous condition which has been calculated to have existed on the basis of what exists now. The calculations are quite good, and the perceptions deduced are quite correct. But the spiritual researcher finds that at the time when that nebulous condition is supposed to have existed, the earth had not yet been born, and the whole solar system had not yet come into being. I wanted to use these calculations simply to show you how our whole inner life of soul must extricate itself from abstractions and immerse itself in living reality, so that our inner pictures themselves can come to life. In my book titled The Riddle of Man, which was published 2 years ago, I made the distinction between real and unreal inner pictures. What matters in brief is that the spiritual researcher has to point out that his path is one which requires him to begin by awakening the means through which he attains knowledge, and that he first has to transform his soul before he can look into the spiritual world. The results he then achieves make it obvious to others that he is not speculating about whether the soul is immortal or whether it passes through birth and death. His very path of research leads him to what is eternal in the human soul, that part which passes through births and deaths. His path of research shows him what lives eternally in the human being. He himself seeks out the object, the thing, the being. Once he has found it, he can then recognize its characteristics, just as one can recognize the color of the rose. It is because of this that it often seems as though the spiritual scientist were merely claiming such and such a thing to be the case, for by way of proof he always has to explain the path by which he reaches his conclusions. You could say he has to begin where other sciences leave off. Once this has been established, there can be a real penetration into realms where it can be said that death is the starting point, just as birth and youth is the starting point of the earthly sciences. But it has to be made clear that the death referred to is not the death that brings to an end what can be seen externally by the senses, which is how it is usually regarded. The death in question is a part of existence, just as the forces which are brought into life by birth are a part of existence. We encounter death not only as a one-off event, for we carry the forces of death, of destruction, within us just as much as we carry within us the forces of birth, those forces given to us at birth which are forces of construction. To understand this fully, we need to do some real research at a boundary between natural and spiritual science. Today, though, I can only mention certain results, and of course my intention is simply to make suggestions. I would need many lectures to explain all the details of what is contained in these suggestions. Let us then, now, go to a boundary between natural and spiritual science. Although science itself has, for the most part, progressed beyond certain views, popular opinion still holds the views that science left behind decades ago. Therefore, many still believe the human nervous system to be nothing but a tool for thinking, feeling, and will. In other words, for experiences of the soul. Those, however, who learn to perceive soul life by means of soul organs, spirit eyes or ears, such as I described in principle earlier on, those who really discover what soul life is, know that to call the brain a tool for thinking is just like talking about walking along a muddy path and leaving footprints there, which someone coming along later tries to explain. How does he explain them? By saying that down in the depths of the earth there are forces that vibrate up and down and thus produce the footprints. The footprints, however, were not caused by those forces at all, but by me, when I walk there. This is how the physiologists today explain that what takes place in the brain is generated by the brain, and there is indeed something in the nervous system that corresponds to every thought and idea, every feeling. Just as my footprints correspond with where I have trodden, so is there something in the brain that does correspond with every impression encountered by the soul. but it is the soul that has impressed it upon the brain. The earth is just as little the organ for my treading or my footprints. It is just as little what produces them as the brain is the organ for all kinds of thoughts or ideation processes. I cannot walk without the ground, for I cannot walk in the air. I need the ground to walk on. And the brain is needed for the same reason, not because it produces the soul impressions, but because the soul processes need the firm foundation upon which to express themselves during the period when the human being lives in a body between birth and death. Today's sciences, which are already brilliant in themselves, will receive their ultimate explanation when this turnaround has come about, this turnaround in the way we think, which I have been describing. It is a revolution more radical than was the transition to the Copernican view of the world over against the view people had cultivated prior to that. And it is also every bit as justifiable over against what has been thought until now as was the Copernican view in comparison with the views that had been held before. There is also another aspect. As we continue along the path of soul research, we find that the processes in the brain and nervous system corresponding with the life of the soul are in fact not constructive processes. They do not arise on account of their being constructive, thriving, flourishing processes in the nervous system, such as those present in the rest of the organism. No, indeed. What the soul carries out in the nervous system is a destructive activity. While we are awake and conscious and not asleep, it is a destructive activity. Only because our nervous system is embedded in us in such a way that it is constantly refreshed by the rest of our organism can the destructive, decomposing, and demolishing activity which thinking lets loose on our nervous system be ever and again counteracted. It is a destructive activity of a quality exactly equivalent to that experienced all in one go when the human being dies, whereupon the whole of the organism disintegrates. Death lives in us constantly, so long as we use our powers of thinking. In tiny amounts, it is constantly within us, and the one-off event that is death is merely a summation of what is constantly at work in us. Although the dying is continuously being balanced out, this balancing is such that when the time comes, death can take place as a matter of course. We must conceive of death as a force at work in our organism, just as we conceive of the forces of life. But look at science. Its way of working is perfectly justified in its field, except that it seeks out only the constructive forces and remains unaware of those that are destructive. That is why it is also not possible for science to observe what continuously arises anew out of what is being destroyed. What arises anew belongs, of course, to the soul and spirit. It is not something bodily, for the body is constantly being destroyed. The new element is not visible for science, since it can only be seen by the kind of observation which I described just now. When we apply this observation, we discover that throughout our whole life, not only is every activity of our soul associated with the foundation it needs in order to function, and which it even destroys, but that the totality of this activity is also a part of a spiritual world which is always around us, and in which we live with the soul and spiritual part of ourselves, just as much as we live in the sense-perceptible world with our physical body. So what spiritual science seeks to bring about is a genuine relationship between the human being and the spiritual world, that genuinely concrete and real spiritual world which also imbues everything's physical. It then becomes possible to observe further how the soul element that works and weaves in us, and which, within the limitations I have described, brings about destruction, is in fact also a part of an overall whole. What I have termed soul development pushes forward from ordinary consciousness to spiritual vision, as I have written in my book titled The Riddle of Man. This visionary consciousness makes it possible to attain knowledge through imagination. Imagination, in this sense, reveals not what is externally visible to the senses, but something that belongs to the human being, although it is not physically visible. This element, which is the first thing to be perceived by such newly awakened consciousness, is what I have been referring to recently as the body of formative forces. This is the supersensible body of the human being, which is active throughout our whole life, from birth, or one should say from conception, right up to our physical death. It is also the bearer of our memories. And as a supersensible being, it is linked to a supersensible world that is external to it. Thus our physical life, with its ordinary consciousness, is like an island. Around this island, and imbuing it, lies what links our body of formative forces with the supersensible world, by which this body in its turn is surrounded. We then see that our world of inner pictures and thoughts, just as I have described it, while being connected to our physical brain that provides it with a firm ground to stand on, is in fact carried by the body of formative forces. This is the bearer of our thinking, and our thoughts are formed within this body of formative forces. So that in the activity of thinking, the human being lives within this body of formative forces. Proceeding now to another soul experience, that of feeling, we discover that things are different. Our feelings and also our emotions and passions do not relate to our life of soul in the way our thinking does. The spiritual researcher finds that the ordinary thoughts we have are attached to the body of formative forces, but that this is not the case with our feelings and emotions. Our feelings and emotions live in us in a much more subconscious way, and at the same time they are linked with something much more far-reaching than merely our life between birth and death. I do not mean that we are without thoughts in this aspect of life, for all feelings are also imbued with thoughts. But the thoughts which imbue our feelings do not usually enter our consciousness. They lie below the level of consciousness. As our feelings surge up, they are interspersed with thoughts, but these thoughts are more far-reaching, and we can only find them by rising up to a higher form of consciousness than that of imagination, namely inspiration, an inspired consciousness, by which I am not referring to anything connected with superstition. You can read about this in detail in my books. By immersing ourselves in this element, which, in so far as our ordinary consciousness is concerned, is asleep, just as we are asleep to ordinary sensory perceptions between falling asleep and waking up again, we shall see how it surges up just as dreams surge up while we sleep. However paradoxical this may sound, it is a fact that our feelings surge up out of the deeper part of the soul. This deeper part of the soul, which can be reached by means of inspiration, inspired consciousness, is the part that lives on between death and a new birth. It is the part that enters into physical surroundings through our conception, or let us say our birth, and which then passes through the gate of death and goes on to lead a spiritual existence under other conditions until we are born once more. When you use the consciousness of inspiration to examine what lives in the world of feeling, you are looking at the human being not only between birth and death, but also in the period lived through between death and a further birth. By telling you this, I am not just telling you how things are, but pointing out how those forces arise in the soul which can perceive feelings, emotions, and passions in a way that enables one to live within them. In a plant, we see what has come into being out of the seed forces. Similarly, we are seeing something which does not just come into being at birth or conception, but which has emerged from a spiritual world. I am quite aware that the present-day scientific view of the world can put forward many objections to these ideas. It will be easy for those who are familiar with today's scientific views to say, quote, "This fellow comes along and describes in an amateurish way, kind of way how certain elements of the soul which he wants to grasp have emerged from the spiritual world. He describes the specific configurations and colors of his feelings in such a way that we are supposed to believe that there exists in these feelings, on the one hand, an indication of prenatal existence, and on the other hand, something akin to the seed of a plant, which contains within it what will be in the plant in the coming year. Has this fellow not heard," close quote, these people will ask, continue quote, "of the marvelous laws of heredity which have been discovered by science? Does he not know what those who first created this branch of science discovered and put together concerning the laws of heredity?" Close quote. Of course, what science points to is perfectly correct. But on the other hand, it is our own forces which work to create our heredity. We work and prepare with our own forces for centuries, sending them down so that through our ancestors and parents, those constellations shall be shaped that will lead to the physical result with which we clothe ourselves when we descend from the spiritual into the physical world. Those who are fully familiar with the wonderful findings of research into heredity will realize that what spiritual science has found in quite another way, by following the opposite path, the one coming from the soul, very clearly corroborates those findings. Whereas what science itself has to say on these matters does not corroborate its own findings at all. This is something I can only touch on here. Turning now to the realm of the will, we note that this is very far removed indeed from what human beings have in their ordinary consciousness. What do we know about what goes on inside us when the thought, quote, "I want that," close quote, turns into the reaching out of our hand? The actual processes of the will are asleep in the human being. With regard to feelings and emotions, we can at least state that in these we dream in ourselves. It is because the will is asleep with regard to ordinary consciousness that the question of freedom is so very fraught. We can only reach an understanding of the processes embedded in the will if we apply the spiritual consciousness of genuine intuition, by which I do not mean the vague and hazy kind of everyday intuitive inkling. In my writings, I have referred to the three stages of consciousness: imagination, inspiration, intuition. To get into the realm of the will that ought to work and live in us, it first has to be hauled up out of the depths of the soul. One then also finds that this will element, too, is imbued with thought, with spiritual thoughts, not ordinary ones, which are something separate. The way we carry our will within us means that what works into it is not only what we have experienced in the spiritual world, or what works into our feelings and emotions between death and a new birth. It is our experiences in former lives on earth that are at work in our will. And at the same time, impulses for future lives on earth also live in what we develop and cultivate in our present will. Genuine spiritual research sees that human life as a whole falls into two parts: those between birth and death, and the much longer ones, because the next physical existence has to be prepared over long eons, which are experienced in the spiritual world. Human life as a whole is composed of these lives, lives on earth over and over again, and spiritual lives over and over again. This is not some fantastic notion. It is what we find if we learn to focus our spiritual eyes on all that is eternal, immortal in the human soul. None of this excludes human freedom. If I build a house this year in which I shall live after 2 years, this does not detract from my freedom any more than does the way one life on earth determines the lives that will follow. It would be a misconception to put this forward as something that infringes the idea of human freedom. So with spiritual research, one gradually begins to reach spiritual facts when one takes death as the starting point. All kinds of observations can be made when death is taken as the foundation on which spiritual research begins, in the same way as birth and burgeoning life is the foundation for physical research. I shall mention a few examples, as I don't want to go round and round without being specific, but would prefer to give some concrete results of anthroposophical spiritual research. In ordinary spiritual life, we can distinguish between violent death due to external causes and death from within, brought on perhaps by an illness or old age. So there are various kinds of death, and when spiritual research looks at the concrete nature of death, we find the following. Let us take the example of a violent death, whether it is brought about by an accident or some other cause. Such a death is an event that brings the present life to an end. The development of one's spiritual awareness of the spiritual world after death depends just as much on this one-off event of death as the development of a basis for our consciousness in life, in the way I have described it, depends on the basis of forces which are given us at birth. After death, the kind of consciousness we develop is different. Here on earth, our consciousness rests on the foundation of our nervous system, in the same way as I stand or walk on the ground. Our consciousness in the spiritual world after death is different, but it is definitely a consciousness. When someone dies a violent death, this is not only something that affects his thinking. Ordinary consciousness ceases with death, of course, but another kind of consciousness begins, and this affects the person's will, of which we have seen that it goes over into subsequent lives on earth. The spiritual researcher possesses the means by which he can investigate what can come up in an earthly life if the previous life ended in violent death. Obviously, many people will say that to speak about such things is foolish, childish, or fantastical. But the results I am talking about are every bit as reliable scientifically, for I only quote reliable results, as are those of the physical sciences. When a violent death intervenes in someone's life, this has consequences for the next life on earth, by bringing it about that at a specific point in that life, a change of direction occurs. Research into the life of the soul is going on even now, but on the whole, this investigates only the most external aspects. A moment can arrive in a person's life when the whole course of his destiny changes, and he steps out on new paths as though inwardly challenged to do so. Such things are termed conversions in America, because people like to give things a name. But it is not necessarily always a matter of religion. A person can be forced into a new direction of life, a permanent change in the direction in which his will takes him. A radical change like this in the direction of one's will originates in the violent end of the previous life. How frequently the type of death is of importance, especially in the middle of the subsequent life, is made obvious to concrete research. If death comes about naturally through sickness or old age, then it has much more importance for the life between death and the next birth than it has for the next earthly life. I wanted to mention these examples to show you that rather than going round and round without being specific, one can indeed gain quite specific insights about details that occur in the context of a lifetime. Even for those who are already convinced that the soul is immortal, spiritual research can make them aware that one need not speak only in general terms about this. For understanding what is eternal in the human soul leads to human life itself being comprehensible. All the remarkable processes one observes, if one has a sense for the soul element in life, for the way the life of soul progresses in the human being, all those wonderful events enter into the picture if one knows that this has to do with repeated lives on earth and repeated lives in the spiritual world. Let me add in parenthesis, in the spiritual world, a human being relates to spiritual beings, not only fellow human beings who have been close to him in his destiny and who have also passed through the gate of death, but also other spiritual beings. In the same way as he relates here on earth to the three earthly kingdoms, the plant, the mineral, and the animal kingdom. The spiritual researcher speaks of specific individual spirits, specific individual spiritual beings, indeed of a spiritual world of actual individual beings, just as here on earth we speak of individual plant and animal beings, and also human beings as they are as physical beings between birth and death. What happens when such spiritual knowledge enters your soul in a certain specific way is something that affects you very profoundly. From what I have said, you will have seen that one can gain knowledge about the spiritual world. Such knowledge is profoundly important for the human soul. In fact, in a way, it changes the human soul into something else. It takes hold of your life of soul, regardless of whether you are a spiritual researcher yourself, or whether you have only heard and understood and absorbed what a spiritual researcher has told you. It does not matter whether you have discovered it yourself, so long as you comprehend it. And you can comprehend all of it, so long as you enter deeply enough into it. It is a matter of having taken it into yourself. Then, once you have grasped the whole inner essence of it, something will enter your soul which will make you realize that this is more significant than anything else that has ever happened in your life. You may have had difficult or sad experiences that have affected you deeply, or joyful ones, uplifting ones. For if you are a spiritual researcher, or someone who sees into the spirit, you need not be unreceptive to such experiences, but can enter into them with as much feeling as anyone who is not yet a spiritual researcher. But when you have grasped the whole inner essence of what spiritual knowledge gives your soul, and can say what it is that this spiritual knowledge gives to your soul, when you can fully realize what your soul has become through this spiritual knowledge, then this event will become more significant than every other experience of destiny that has come upon you. The other experiences do not grow smaller, but this one grows larger. Spiritual knowledge then enters in through the life of your soul as a part of your destiny. When spiritual knowledge enters in through the life of your soul, you begin to comprehend human destiny itself. From that moment onward, a light shines on your human destiny and clarifies it. From that moment onward, you realize that having this experience of destiny in such a purely spiritual way enables you to explain how destiny has positioned you in life, how one's destiny hangs on threads that have been spun out from former lives on earth, as well as lies between death and a new birth. Threads that then spin on from this life into the one that follows. You realize that ordinary consciousness merely dreams its way through destiny. Ordinary consciousness merely accepts destiny without understanding it, just as one accepts dreams. Spiritual consciousness, in which we wake up as we wake up from dreams into ordinary consciousness, gains us a new relationship to destiny. We recognize destiny as that which works with us on our overall life, the life that proceeds on and on through births and deaths. This must not be understood in a superficial way, by simply saying that one has brought one's misfortune on oneself. To do this would be to misunderstand spiritual research. Indeed, it would be to cast slanderous aspersions on it. Parenthesis, and anyway, a misfortune need not necessarily have its cause in one's former life. It may have happened spontaneously, in which case there would be consequences in the next life, and in the whole of the life between the two lives on earth. For it is often to be seen that from misfortune, and also suffering and pain, there grows a different kind of consciousness in the spiritual world. Close parenthesis. What happens through this new spiritual knowledge is that meaning enters our whole life. Understanding for our destiny, which we normally dream our way through, but which we now come to comprehend. Something comes to the fore especially when we focus on this spiritual knowledge. And that is that we cannot simply go on saying, well, so after death the soul enters into another life, but let's wait until that happens. Let's live life now as it is lived in the physical body, and wait until later to see what happens after death. This whole question is a matter of consciousness. Of course, what happens after death is in some way connected with the life we live here in our physical body. Here, through our body, we have the consciousness of the normal waking state. After death, though, we have a consciousness that is not spatial and founded on our nervous system, but temporal and built on looking backward. We have in our nervous system the counterbalance and counterstroke for our ordinary consciousness between birth and death, whereas the foundation for our consciousness in the spiritual world between death and a new birth is formed by what is already in our consciousness here. Just as we are here, surrounded by the world, so once we have died, does our life present itself before us as an important organ. Therefore, much depends on the consciousness we have while we are in our physical body, since this reaches out into the consciousness that comes to meet us after death. For example, as often happens with present-day habits of thought, a person may be exclusively concerned with physical thoughts and ideas arising through the senses. It is memories and in everything taking place in his soul. Such a person has in his consciousness only ideas based on ordinary life. This person, too, is building up the world that will surround him after death. We build up our environment in accordance with what we are inwardly, with what we are inwardly. Just as someone born in Europe cannot see himself surrounded by America, just as we receive our environment from the surroundings we are born into, so do we in some way determine the environment, the place where we exist, through what we have created whilst in our body. Take an extreme case, which, however, is not very likely to occur. Think of a person who resists all supersensible ideas, someone who has become an atheist and has not gained, even from religion, the slightest feeling that he might want to take an interest in such things. I know that I am speaking in paradoxes, but what I am saying has a good foundation in spiritual science. Such a person is condemning himself to remain in the sphere of the earth, to remain here with his consciousness, whereas someone who has taken in spiritual ideas can enter into a spiritual environment. The person who has ideas based solely on the senses condemns himself to remain in the sense-perceptible environment. We can work in a beneficial way when we are in our physical body in the physical world. But here our physical body acts as a protective cloak. But if we remain present in the physical world after death, we work in a detrimental way. When our consciousness harbors physical ideas and inner pictures after death, we become destroyers. I have already pointed out, in connection with the laws of heredity, how the human being's forces intervene in the physical world, even when he is in the spiritual world. Those who cultivate only a physical consciousness, and thus condemn themselves to remaining in the physical world, become the focus for destructive forces that interfere in what happens in people's lives and in the world at large. So long as we are in our body, that body remains a protection, even if we have nothing but materialistic thoughts to do with sense-perceptible things. In fact, our body is a far greater protection than we imagine. It is most strange, but someone who can look into the whole context of the spiritual world comes to be quite sure about a certain fact. Since we are unable in ordinary consciousness to take in living concepts, but can only absorb dead ones, which hold us back from entering into our spiritual surroundings, it is a fact that if we were not separated from our environment by our senses, if our senses did not keep things away from us, if we could make our thoughts and ideas effective rather than just having them within us once things have passed through our senses, then already, here in the physical world, our life of thoughts would have a deathly, paralyzing effect. This is because such thoughts and ideas are in a certain way destructive for everything that is grasped by them. It is solely because they are retained within us that these thoughts and ideas are not destructive. They only bring about destruction when they come to expression in machines, in tools which are something dead that has been removed from living nature. Although this is just a picture, it nevertheless corresponds to a reality. So, when a human being enters into the spiritual world with nothing but physical thoughts and ideas, he becomes a focus of destruction. I have given this one example in place of many, which could show us that no, we cannot wait to see what will happen. It is up to us, in our own being, to develop thoughts and ideas which are either only materialistic or which are supersensible, thus preparing in the one way or the other way for the life to come. That life will, of course, be entirely different, but it does evolve out of the life we lead here. This is the essential fact that we must realize. A good many things can crop up for us out of spiritual science that are different from what we expected. I must therefore conclude with a few more remarks. One might easily presume that to be someone who can enter into the spiritual world, one must of necessity become a spiritual researcher. This is not necessary, although I have written a great deal in my book, How to Know Higher Worlds, about what the soul must do in order to enter there. Anyone can do this to some extent today, but not everyone needs to do so. What you develop in your soul is an entirely inner affair, but what it leads to is that the truths being researched can be formulated into concepts, so that you can clothe in thoughts and ideas, like those I have put forward today, what a spiritual researcher tells you. It is something that can be communicated. One of the laws of spiritual research is that it does not matter whether you have found these things out through your own research, or whether you have been informed about them by a reliable source. It is not a matter of finding these things out yourself, for the important thing is that you have them and develop them within yourself. It is, then, a misunderstanding to assume that everyone must become a spiritual researcher. But nowadays, someone who is a spiritual researcher will have the need, as I had the need, to give an account of the path he has followed for his research. This is not only because anyone today can, to some extent, tread the described path without coming to any harm, but also because anyone has the right to ask, quote, "What did you do to arrive at these results?" Close quote. That is why I have described these things. I also believe that those who do not want to become spiritual researchers do nevertheless want to find out how a spiritual researcher arrives at his findings. where these findings are what all those need, who, in keeping with the stage of human evolution, has now reached, want to lay foundations for the life that must develop in human souls. The age is now over in which the discoveries of spiritual research and what they brought about in human soul development were very much kept hidden away from the public eye. In olden times it was strictly forbidden to pass on what was hidden, and even today those who know about these secrets of life, and there are not a few such individuals, shrink from divulging them. The implication is that if you have received such things from someone else who is a teacher, you will do well not to pass them on under any circumstances. It is advisable to pass on only one's own discoveries, and it is these that can and indeed must be placed in the service of the rest of humanity. Even the few brief hints I have given today will show what spiritual research can mean for the individual person. But it is not only for individuals that such research is important. And, in order to show very briefly why this is, I want to conclude by saying a few words about something of which very little account is taken nowadays. Let me draw your attention to a remarkable phenomenon. The second half of the 19th century saw the spectacular rise of a particular scientific trend, namely, the explanation of living nature linked with the name of Darwin. Enthusiastic scholarly researchers and their enthusiastic pupils carried this trend forward throughout the latter decades of the 19th century. I may even here have mentioned the extraordinary development to which this led. As early as the 1860s, a gigantic movement came into being under the leadership of Haeckel, a movement that strove to throw aside everything that was old and redesigned the whole view of the world to fit in with Darwin's concepts. Even today, there are still those who stress how grand and important it would be if instead of having a wisdom-filled guidance for the universe, we could have explained, on the basis of Darwinism, how everything has come into being. In 1869, Edward von Hartmann came forward with his title Philosophy of the Unconscious, turning against Darwinism, which saw the world purely in external terms, and pointing to the need for inner forces, though he did this in an inadequate, merely philosophical manner, having no spiritual research to go on. Those whose enthusiasm focused on Darwinism were, of course, prepared to call this philosopher a dilettante, to whom it was not necessary to listen. Writings were published mocking the dilettante Edward von Hartmann and stating that there was no call for a genuine scientist to take note of such views. An anonymous paper appeared with a brilliant refutation of Hartmann's thoughts. The scientists and those who thought, as they did, were in full agreement with this paper, for it completely refuted Edward von Hartmann. Everything that could be brought forward in a scholarly manner on the basis of science was indeed brought forward in this paper, written by an anonymous author against Hartmann, in rather the same way as objections are put forward today against spiritual research. This paper was much applauded. Haeckel intoned, quote, "Here is a genuine scientist writing to refute that dilettante Hartmann. Here we see what a real scientist can do. Indeed, I could not have written anything better myself. Let him come forward, and we will accept him as one of our own." Close quote. In short, the scientists made a good deal of propaganda about this paper, which suited them so well, and it was soon out of print. A second edition was needed, and then the author himself came forward. He was Edward von Hartmann. Here was someone who taught the world an important lesson. Any spiritual researcher today who comes up against what is written against spiritual research could produce all of it off the top of his own head with ease, just as Edward von Hartmann was himself quite capable of presenting everything the scientists had to say against him, and did so. But all this is merely an introduction to what I really want to say, which is this. Oskar Hertwig is one of Haeckel's most important pupils, and has himself trodden the assiduous and honest and great path of scientific research. Last year, he brought out a very fine book titled Das Werden der Organismen, eine Widerlegung von Darwins Zufallstheorie, The Evolution of Organisms, a refutation of Darwin's theory of chance. In this book, he points to matters like those also brought up by Edward von Hartmann. This is an almost unique case of the very next generation, the one which grew up under the direct influence of the master, turning its back on something that had been expected to provide the basis for a whole worldview, and even give answers regarding the spiritual world. A good Darwinist refuting Darwinism. In fact, he goes even further, and this is what I want to point to at the end of this lecture. At the end of his excellent and fine book, Oscar Hertwig states that a worldview of the kind put forward by Darwin is more than merely a theoretical construct, for it affects the whole of people's lives, right down into what they do, want, feel, and think. He says, quote, "Interpretations of Darwin's theory, which is so ambiguous owing to its very vagueness, have made it applicable in a great variety of ways to other realms of economic, social, and political life. As though from a Delphic oracle, it has been possible to take whatever one wanted and make use of it with reference to social, political, health, medical, and other questions by using the science of a Darwinistically reworked biology with its unalterable laws to back up one's claims. If, however, these presumed laws are in fact no such thing, does this not mean that there could be social dangers in applying them so variously to other fields? Do not believe that human society can spend half a century using such phrases as, subquote, the inexorable struggle for existence, the survival of the fittest, of the most useful, of the most suitable, perfection through selective breeding, close subquote, and so on, as freely as eating its daily bread, without finding its ideas becoming more deeply and more persistently influenced by them. It would not be hard to find many phenomena to prove that this is happening, and this is the very reason why judgment as to whether Darwinism is true or erroneous has implications far beyond the scope of the biological sciences." Close quote. Life is now showing us on every side what is revealed by such a theory. And the same question, also impinging on life, arises from the angle of spiritual science. We are living in a time of sorrow, one that is tragic for humanity. It is a time that has surely evolved out of human beings' inner pictures and ideas. Those of us who look at the links between such things from the point of view of spiritual science know what it is that connects the events now confronting us externally with all the tragedy we are experiencing. We are experiencing a great deal, and people imagine they know what is going on. They imagine they can fully comprehend this reality with their concepts, but they cannot. And being unable to comprehend the events fully on the basis of their concepts, they blunder into them only to discover the chaos that ensues and with which we are now surrounded. Spiritual science arises out of an inner necessity. But this is not the only reason, for it would certainly have arisen anyway out of inner necessity, even if external events had not now pointed the way like a mighty and powerful sign. Although the traditional view of the world is fine as regards today's scientific attitude, the fact is that this view will never be able to come to grips with social, legal, or political matters in the world. In fact, if I may put it like this, people fail to cope with reality, and it is this that brings in a new angle which points toward spiritual science with powerful signs. A spiritual science which seeks for concepts that are in tune with reality, concepts drawn from this very reality that will therefore also be capable of supporting the world socially and indeed politically. However strongly we imagine we shall be capable of extricating ourselves from the chaos on the basis of current concepts, which take no note of spiritual science, we shall be unable to do so, for it is spirit that holds sway in the real world. And because human actions influence the realities of social and political life, people need to arrive at fruitful concepts. They need thoughts, feelings, and will impulses that have been drawn down out of the spirit. Politics and the social sciences will in future need something for which only spiritual science can provide the basis. This is something that is of outstanding importance for contemporary history. I myself can only make a few isolated suggestions in this lecture, which has already become quite long enough. What I want to point out is that the spiritual science coming into being today in an orderly and systematic way is something which the best individuals wish to bring about. If the choice were mine, I would attach one particular name to this spiritual science. For 30 years or more, I have been working to give ever greater clarity to the ideas which Goethe derived from reality in his marvelous theory of metamorphosis, in which he strove to bring alive what would otherwise have been dead concepts. In his day, only a beginning could be made. But if we regard Goethe as belonging not only historically to his own time, but also to the present day, we find that especially his theory of metamorphosis brings into being living concepts which can then find their way into spiritual science. I would love to give the name Goetheanism to what I mean by spiritual research, for the latter rests on the healthy foundation of a way of looking at reality which would have met with Goethe's approval. And I would greatly prefer to give the name Goetheanum to the building at Dornach, which is devoted to that spiritual research, and through which that research has become more known than would perhaps otherwise have been the case. For to call the building the Goetheanum would be to show that the spiritual research carried out today stands firmly and healthily within the process of human evolution. Of course, many people today still believe that they are adhering to Goethe's view of the world when they state that Goethe was the one who recognized nature as the highest, and who even saw how the spirit emerges from nature. It was indeed Goethe who, as a very young man, said, quote, "She thought, and she ponders constantly." Close quote. Nature ponders constantly, though not as a human being does, but as nature does. Well, even as spiritual researchers, we can certainly be in agreement with a type of naturalism that regards nature as being filled with spirit in the way Goethe did. And the reply we can give to those who always believe that one should come to a halt at the boundaries of knowledge, since there can be no path beyond, can be framed in Goethe's own words. So let me conclude by quoting the words Goethe uttered about another well-deserving researcher who represented Kant's later views. Quote, "Into the core of nature no earthly mind can enter. Happy the mortal creature to whom she shows no more than the outer rind." Close quote. Goethe then countered these words with others, which show how well he knew that individual who awakens the spirit within himself will find the spirit in the world as well, and also himself as a spirit therein. Quote, "Into the core of nature no earthly mind can enter. Happy the mortal creature to whom she knows no more than the outer rind. For 60 years I've heard your sort announce. It makes me swear, though quietly. Nature has neither core nor outer rind, being all things at once. It's yourself you should scrutinize to see whether your center, whether you are center or periphery." Close quote. Spiritual science wants to lead human beings to examine seriously whether they are either center or periphery. They are center if they fully comprehend their whole reality. If they comprehend themselves as center, they can press onward to the spirit in nature. And when that happens, something will enter into human evolution with regard to spiritual research, which will resemble what had to happen when Copernicus moved from the visible to the invisible when pointing to something visible. In order to reach the supersensible realm, human beings will have to take the trouble to comprehend the supersensible within themselves. To do this, one need not become a spiritual researcher, but one must indeed sweep away all those prejudices that lay siege to the soul when one endeavors to comprehend what is meant by spiritual research in the Goethean sense. These are the few suggestions I wanted to make today. In fact, suggestions are all one can voice. For if I wanted to explain all this in every detail, I would have to give a great many lectures. I believe that these few explanations will suffice to show that something is waiting to be won from the process of human evolution. Something that, when found, will awaken the human soul to abundant life. No one need fear that this will cause the soul to wither, or that other things might die away, not even their religious life. It is as Goethe said, quote, "If science and art are yours, then religion is yours too. But if you lack either of these, then may you at least have religion." Close quote. So let us allow ourselves to say something that is in keeping with today's way of thinking. If you find the way to the paths of spiritual science, you will also discover true religious life. But if you do not find the way to paths of spiritual science, then it must be feared that you are likely to lose also the religious path that is so much needed for the future of humanity. The end of Lecture 1.